So continuing our mini history of, I'm saying yoga as exercise, but in a certain way, I'm just saying, you know, yoga as a movement practice, different from yoga as a practice in stillness, right? The word yoga for the first 1,000 years of its use as a, maybe 1500 years almost, for its use as a pointer toward, you know, a body of state altering practices was primarily meditation practices in stillness, going all the way through the era of the tantras, all the way through the era of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, which is early in the tantric period. And as we talked about last week, practices that are more active start to arise in maybe the 10th and 11th century more fully. They're always there in various ways. You know, even the Buddha is walking and lying down and sitting and standing to modulate energy. But what we think of as postural yoga and pranayama really starting to arise in postural yoga as shapes starting to arise in maybe the 10th, 11th century. Pranayama has been there for a very long time. We have reports in the Buddhist canon itself of the Buddha practicing long breath holding. The Buddha's reports about breath holding in the Pali Canon are actually some of the earliest detailed descriptions in any tradition of breath holding. So it's used by scholars of yoga and pranayama as one of the earliest reference points for those practices. And we talked about the arising of physical practice initially as energetic practices to sculpt internal energetic process, the use of mudra, these shapes and bandha bonds in the body. And so this takes us bit by bit into the development of a variety of postures. The different postures start to arise initially as, you know, shapes that are primarily meditative and channel the flow of energy. And then bit by bit, other shapes that support the cultivation of energy. So, you know, we get different postures added in to the vocabulary of yoga. And by about the 17th century or so, so we're, you know, sometime into the British Empire in India. So early yoga, Hatha yoga, develops under the Mughal Empire, the Muslim Empire in India, and is tolerated. The Mughal Empire is religiously tolerant, so there's a lot of different folks are there. The Buddhist tradition still relatively declines under the Mughal Empire, as do the Hindu tantric traditions mostly decline. But there are yogic sects, particularly the Nath sect, that thrives, and there's several different Nath sects that survive into the present day. But the, you know, the British are there by the you know, late 16th century, and really established into the 17th. And we start to get more postures brought into the yogic corpus that come from a variety of sources. And alongside this adding of postures into the idea of traditional yogic practice, there's a few streams of thought and practice developing. And among them is a bringing together of a few different streams within Hinduism broadly. One is the stream of the ascetic yogi. This is the yogi who has traditionally been the practitioner of Hatha yoga. This is a mostly celibate, except for some who are practicing certain kinds of sexual yogas, which again primarily come from the Hatha tradition, not so much from the tantric tradition, classically speaking. But most of these ascetic yogis are in celibate renunciate orders, monastic orders. And by the mid British Empire, by the 18th and 19th century, they are in some parts of India still, quite revered and feared. There's a lot of mythology starts to appear about like the yogis who will come and like, take children away or who will kidnap your daughters, things like that. The sense of the relationship of these ascetic yogis to the sexual practices starts to be quite taboo and edgy. And stories are told about them as being these kind of like superhuman figures who are, powerful and spiritual, but also frightening. There are also streams of yoga that are, resistant to that and assimilate more with the colonial system. And so and the body of postures continues to develop. Hinduism under the British Empire has formed into what we now think of as a single religion out of what previously were many, many, many different localized spiritual traditions and religions. The word Hindu probably begins being used in about the 16th century, initially by the Persians, referring to people around the Indus River. So the Hindu people, the Indus River, which now runs through Pakistan. And so from there to the south are the Hindu people. The British pick up the use of the term, the South Asian folks themselves pick up the use of the term. And remember that before the that even in the time of the Mughal Empire, not all of India is united as one kingdom. There's still multiple kingdoms present in various kinds of connection. And but the British Empire brings together many of these disparate areas much more than had been done before. And the British, in their kind of, everything I understand must be just one thing, kind of everything I don't understand must be all one thing sort of approach, they just lump all of the non-Christian or Muslim traditions that they find there together all as one thing. And so then you get things that previously were separate religions, like the Vaishnava religion of folks who worship Vishnu as the ultimate deity and the manifestations of Radha and Krishna and Sita and Rama primarily, based in Vrindavan and Mathura and the center south of India, and then the Dravidian religions down south, completely different, and the tantric and non-tantric Shaiva and Shakta, sects from further north, Shaiva worshiping Shiva as the ultimate deity or Shiva Shakti as the ultimate deity, often in the north around the river Ganga, in Varanasi, the sacred city, and further north. And these just get all lumped together as Hindu, even though they are wildly different. And so this, they, and so then the word Hindu becomes this catch-all for a huge variety of things. And as this takes on in the local culture, in the colonized culture, it turns by the 20th century into a kind of syncretic philosophical understanding called the Sanatana Dharma, or the eternal Dharma. The Western parallel to that is called the perennial philosophy, the idea among some European thinkers that all the great philosophies could be kind of boiled down to one, core myth. And that has largely been rejected now in the post-colonial period, that idea itself, that you could boil everything down and it's all the same in the end, that's a colonial perspective unto itself. But the Sanatana Dharma is a way of thinking about the many different strands that come together to form modern Hinduism that have a common root. And that common root is traced to the Upanishads and the Vedas, the ancient core texts that predate the splitting of the schools, that predate Vedanta, which is the core school behind the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata, that predate Sankhya and Buddhism, which are the two core schools behind Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, and that predate the devotional schools that appear in the Puranas that eventually become Shaivism and Shaktism and Vaishnavism, etc. So the British Empire, all of that is a way to say that the British Empire takes all this stuff, brings it together, and the response within these various traditions is infinitely varied. Like there's local responses in many different places. In some places, the yoga becomes more strongly like mainstream religious Hindu. So like up in the north, in Rishikesh, Swami Shivananda, who's this extraordinary monk, sannyasin there, builds up a yoga practice that has a core set of postures, not a huge variety of postures, but a core set of basic postures. But then those postures are embedded in a very devotional Hindu framework. And so if you do Shivananda practice, you learn the postures, but you also learn, you also have a sattvic diet, and you learn about, the doshas, and you are chanting to Shiva and Shakti. You're chanting bhajans, you're singing prayers, you are learning purification practices, you're doing mantra, all of these forms or technologies that are part of the Shaiva Hindu body of practice. So Shivananda, Shiva is his name, so the bliss of Shiva. Shivananda is a Shaiva Hindu, and he stitches together a yoga that becomes the root of what's called the Northern School. He lives in the early part of the 20th century, through the mid-century. One of his students, several of his students, one of his students, Swami Sachidananda, breaks off or develops further integral yoga, not to be confused with the integral yoga of Sri Aurobindo down in the south. So keep those separate, but two different folks to use the term integral. But Shivananda and integral develop out of this northern school. And they have this core devotional Hindu approach to yoga. And the postural work is really stitched into this Hindu framework. And so folks who practice in those lineages then inherit some of that approach, some of those chants, some of those approaches. Down south, in what, up until well into the British period, was an entirely different kingdom with different languages, different cultures, different, traditions, different gods. Down in Mysore, in the central southern India, the king of Mysore, the Maharaja, in the early part of the 20th century, employs a Vaishnava scholar. So he's a Vaishnava devoted to Vishnu and a scholar of the Yoga Sutras named Sri Tirumalai Krishnamacharya. And he gets employed in the palace of the Maharaja of Mysore to teach yoga postures and philosophy to the Maharaja's kids. So he's employed in the royal household. And Krishnamacharya is a very interesting figure. He's an extraordinary innovator and at the same time is deeply traditional. He's a scholar, and he's not a monk, the way that Shivananda is up north. And he begins to teach the kid and one thing about Krishnamacharya, this is true in a way both about Krishnamacharya and Shivananda, but there's a rejection, particularly by Krishnamacharya, of the ascetic Hatha Yoga tradition. So Krishnamacharya will say that the practices the Hatha Yogis are doing, these mud smeared ascetics who are sleeping on beds of nails and doing contortion postures in the marketplace, begging for alms, that this is a corrupt and indecent form of yoga. He's particularly scandalized by the way that the sexual practices have remained at least part of the mythology of the ascetic yogi, even if it's not happening very much. And he it partly seems like he favors a kind of, more assimilated yoga, like a yoga that's more tolerable to the colonial overlords, but also a yoga that's more tolerable to his employer, who is a royal family, But you see in Krishnamacharya's writings a rejection of what he calls Hatha Yoga, and there's some speculation that one of the reasons why Krishnamacharya celebrates the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali so as much as he does, and it's really because of Krishnamacharya that the Yoga Sutra is a text in modern yoga now. Some folks think that Krishnamacharya celebrates the Yoga Sutra because it's a way of rejecting the Hatha Yoga tradition as being corrupt, as being tantric, as being sexual, as being unclean or impure. And so then he leapfrogs back earlier than it, because Patanjali, remember, is from like the 4th century of the Common Era. It's completely meditative. It's probably related to the Buddhist Yogacara tradition. And it's about entering deep states of samadhi and concentration. And there's no postural work in it at all. There's also no devotional Hinduism in it at all, right? It's a work based in Mahayana Buddhism and Sankhya, which was an early post-Upanishadic form. This is getting to be a very technical historical talk. You're rolling with it. You can go back and watch the recording later. We're going to keep going. Thanks for hanging with it. So, but we're actually at the boundary, historically, of stuff that many of us are connected with, because Krishnamacharya, teaching the kids of the Maharaja of Mysore, starts to give asana demonstrations, and some of the origins of modern postural yoga then are in some of the earliest photographs we have of them are of Krishnamacharya's performances that he would put on, where he would have the kids that he was teaching, and they were kids, so they're very bendy. He's got these kids doing extreme postures in a kind of choreography. And so performativity is at the heart of Western yoga. Right, and it's very different from up in the north. You never really see Shivananda like putting on an asana performance, and Shivananda's asanas are not acrobatic, they're not contortionist. But Krishnamacharya pulls in all of these different practices, and he starts to pull in stuff that are exact repetitions of contortion poses that have come through town with European circuses, and calisthenics that have come through. He brings in some Swedish gymnastics, and he brings in some calisthenics from the YMCA and the Christian evangelists who have come with the Young Men's Christian Association. And you start to see some of the same ideas that were popular in Victorian England, like the idea that physical health was close to godliness. And you start to hear echoes of this in Indian teachers about yoga. There's a parallel stream in early 20th century postural yoga where there are some writings of folks saying if we are, you know, saying Indian folks writing and saying the Indian people are soft and weak and over spiritualized and not manly. So you can hear in this a response to Victorian ideas of manliness, you know. And in order to become tougher and more manly, we need to actually build up the Indian body so that it can resist the colonial overlord. And so there is an aspect where native Indian, like martial arts, start to expand at this point. And exercises from the martial arts are brought into early postural yoga as well, with the same kind of, you know, it's just a spiritualized exercise form, the same way that Tai Chi was a secret way to develop martial arts underneath, you know, an occupying power without it looking like you were practicing fighting, or the way that capoeira is developed to practice a fighting form in the disguise of a dance form. And so part of early yoga contains some of these, you know, postures and gestures brought in from other Indian martial arts and martial training. So Krishnamacharya is putting on asana performances in Mysore for the children of the Maharaja. He doesn't have that job very long because that Maharaja dies and his successor, his son, isn't so into yoga. So Krishnamacharya loses the job. But in the short period that he's doing this, he gets two extremely ambitious students. Each of them is a student with him for less than a few weeks. One of them is named BKS Iyengar, and one of them is named Sri Patabi Joyce. They are both with him for very short periods of time. Iyengar says, I was with him for, you know, I don't know what it is, like 11 days or something. I don't know. It seems very short. Krishnamacharya forces him to perform the splits in a performance because some other kid is absent and can't do it. Iyengar forces himself into it, even though he's never done the practice, and then he can't walk for like a year because he tears his hamstring ligaments, I presume. Iyengar then goes off on his own and begins to develop the postures that he learned from Krishnamacharya into a system for disciplining the body into perfection. And he starts to use ropes and sticks and props, and he develops a highly precise postural vocabulary, but also a fairly intense one, where folks are getting hurt and injured, but also, you know, falling for the extraordinary charisma of this wild, intense teacher who will, you know, strap your legs into being straight and tell you to, you know, very subtly expand the connection between your heel and the floor and in very precise ways. And Iyengar practice develops into the present day as a not a flow practice, not an ecstatic practice, but a very, very precise awareness and postural practice where extreme precision of posture is used essentially, eventually, as a meditative object. His practice has recently been deconstructed very deeply, and some of its abusive roots brought to the foreground, but also just some of the metaphysical aspects that Iyengar brings in. But he's, you know, he's really he's a branch of the Krishnamacharya lineage. And he was an innovator, and he and you know, very most of what he taught, he innovated himself, you know, and then again borrowed from things like, you know, contortion manuals and things like that. But he was an extraordinary innovator, and much of what he did was really became the foundation of modern postural yoga, particularly the alignment instructions and the very precise alignment instructions that eventually influenced flow and Anusara and a ton else, including making their way up to northern tradition schools, where if you go to a Shivananda class now, you're likely to hear postural like alignment instructions that were not being taught in the 60s, but that have become the standard instructions for postures, a lot of the precision of alignment instruction was really brought in by Iyengar. Krishnamacharya's other most famous student was Pattabhi Jois, who sets up a yoga shala or a yoga school in Mysore and takes the practice in a completely different direction. Starts stringing together groups of postures that Krishnamacharya had taught. And he picks up this idea that Krishnamacharya seems to have been the originator of. The word vinyasa is not an ancient word. And in the early yogic texts, up until the 20th century, there's virtually no mention of stringing postures together in forms of flow. All of the early postural work up to the 20th century is almost entirely postures held for a very long time in stillness. And remember, we mentioned maybe last week or sometime recently in the Tibetan system that broke off from Hatha Yoga in the Middle Ages but continued to develop on its own. In the Tibetan system, very often postures are held with the breath held, even. So, posture in stillness, breath held. So, you're really gathering the energy into a specific channel and holding it there. Krishnamacharya takes this word vinyasa, that just means perhaps to link things together, and begins to innovate a way to come in and out of postures. And so, in Krishnamacharya's writings, you see the word vinyasa used to refer to one breath in and one breath out of the posture. So, like you're laying on your belly with your forehead on the ground, you would inhale to lengthen the front line of the body and to come into like a cobra, lifting the chest, lifting the face. And then you would exhale, coming back down, forehead to the floor. So, one inhale to come into the extension, one exhale to come back out into flexion or neutral. And so in Krishnamacharya's style, vinyasa is not a whole bunch of poses strung together like a choreography, but is really, you know, each pose, every pose will have a vinyasa that will be a kind of like inhale into the pose and exhale out of the pose. I love this kind of practice. I do a bunch of this myself in my teaching. I like to do it slowly without a lot of muscular tension, like a qigong, so that there's really an inhaling into extension and an exhaling to flexion. One of my favorite teachers and very influential, named Alice Juanu, who studied with Pattabhi Jois and many other teachers, eventually left Ashtanga for a variety of reasons, as many did, and developed a beautiful vinyasa style. Pranams to Alice, uses this kind of one breath vinyasa in and out of a posture. So Krishnamacharya had innovated this like breathe into the posture and breathe out of it. Pattabhi Jois takes that and takes this basic calisthenic form that is, you know, partly similar to a jump back and push up that you would find in European calisthenics. And it's partly strung together from a stylized prostration also that was in use in Vaishnava Hindu practice, and comes up with the form known as the Surya Namaskar, the sun salutation. So a form where from standing you can come into extension, come into flexion, folding forward, step back or jump back, come into the extension of cobra or upward dog, extend back to downward dog. Reverse the whole thing to come back up, and then add warrior poses into it. And you get this very versatile transitional process where you can start and end with standing, flow using the breath. And now the vinyasa is stringing together a whole bunch of postures. Inhale to extension, exhale to fold. Inhale to lift the heart, exhale to jump back. Inhale to upward dog, exhale to go back. So you're using the same one breath vinyasa flow style of Krishnamacharya, but now you're using it as essentially the basis of a choreography. And so Pattabhi Jois innovates this choreography, and then he strings together, you know, a couple hundred poses into long series, the primary series, the secondary series, etc., eventually five or six series, series, everything beyond series two is essentially impossible contortion stuff that he got from contortionists. And part of what starts to arise in these modern systems, particularly in the South, is postures that are not just meditative, and they're not just stretches. So a lot of the basic postural set is stretches, like deep forward folds is the classic kind of posture, standing and sitting. And what Patabi Joyce starts to bring in, and even more than Iyengar, because Iyengar is just doing static poses also, Patabi Joyce in the flow style starts to bring in not just postures, they're really movements now, because of they're all strung together with vinyasas that engage quite a bit more strength, right? So now we're starting to have things that look like push-ups, chaturangas. We're starting to have things that really develop strength in the legs and arms and in the core. You know, Navasana, boat pose, becomes more and more and more and more prominent until you get systems developing, you know, like the system, you know, taught by Anna Forrest in the 1980s and 90s and aughts, that has elevated core work now to the heart of the entire thing through the recognition that the early 20th century yogis, that yogas that were mostly stretch-based and didn't have a lot of strength work in them, were overstretching ligaments, and they were leaving folks' postural muscles unactivated. And so the postural work, meaning like helping us actually sit upright, starts to become more and more and more central, coincidentally, as yoga arrives in a posture, in a population of people who spend all of our time sitting in chairs, which is awful for your postural muscles. So of course we need core work, and that gets brought in. And so through the 20th century, we get this, and really like building from the maybe 15th or 16th century, there's a dozen, two dozen poses, into the late 20th century, where there's a couple hundred poses in, you know, for a while, you know, my yoga studio had, there was this beautiful map of the Ashtanga primary series that was made at one point, with like little tiny pictures of, you know, a couple hundred poses. And you know, that was sort of the Bible of like, can you do all of these? And I couldn't, but you know, many. And part of what we can see happen is that throughout, really for the last 1,000 years, but particularly in the last couple hundred, the postural aspect of yoga developed in response to the needs of the population that it was meeting. And so as it was brought into ideas of, you know, strengthening and liberating the Indian body, or, you know, building up a foundation for strong meditation, for lay people or for monastics, and then, you know, what was needed for it to be well performed, you know, and dramatic in a performance, all of these things start to get added in, so that by the late 20th century, when yoga is really being brought to Europe and the Americas, what's coming over are both representatives of both the northern and southern schools, and the Tibetan schools would come much, much later. So initially, you know, in the 60s, you get, you know, you have Iyengar teachers, you have Ashtanga teachers start to show up kind of in the mid 70s. You start to get the earliest of the Ashtanga teachers in the West. Folks like Ram Dass, you know, came over with some yoga practices, and probably the Northern school practices got here first, right? Because the Beatles were exposed to them in Rishikesh. Ram Dass was exposed to them in the North. So the Northern school arrives first in the kind of earlier 60s. And then later on into the 70s, the Southern school arrives. But because the Southern school is way more athletic and energetic, and diverse in its postural work and strength oriented, it's the one that really takes off. And so it's the one that becomes flow and power yoga and Anusara and forest and the vast profusion of things that it turned into. I started in Ashtanga in the mid 90s myself, but already, there were like strict Ashtanga classes, but then there were also just a whole bunch of folks just calling it flow or vinyasa. And it could be any choreography, any way that you wanted to string things together. But we were still mostly using Patabi Joyce's innovation of using the sun salutation process to string things together. It's a really nice sequence for stringing together, particularly the standing poses, And remember that the entire body of standing poses is essentially a modern innovation. So everything before about the 19th century, it's all on the ground. And so, anything else to say? Yoga as posture. I'll stop there because we want to have time for some questions. That was a little slam bam, but we got through the 20th century. So I'd love to hear your questions. And if there's seeds of questions that open up, whole new avenues, we can continue with this in subsequent weeks. Hi. Thanks for joining us for this talk and practice. If these recordings are helpful for you, please consider supporting the Sangha with a donation of any amount. You can find links to our website and the donation page below in the description. Liking and subscribing helps the channel, and I'm grateful for your presence, your practice, and anything you can give to support our little community. Thank you so much. Take care.